Yeah, so I'll be talking about how scale-free our biological networks are, actually how not scale-free they are, and whether it actually matters for the evolutionary models. And this work was done together with Ernest Wheat, who's now at Lancaster University in England. A couple of weeks ago, Andreas Wagner was giving a talk here, I think, and the talk was entitled, "Is the RNA Network Biology?" And he presented several facts where he kind of put a question mark on certain myths about biological networks. But while this question is being debated, obviously many people are considering biological networks. And these are just three examples of various biological networks, protein-protein interaction network that we've heard a couple of talks about them this week. This is where two proteins are connected by some physical interactions or they make certain complexes. Metabolic networks, where enzymes and substrates are connected if they participate in one reaction. And gene regulatory networks, where two genes are connected if the level of one gene modulates expression of another one by either activation or repression. And these are examples of kind of physical networks where there are some interactions between elements in the networks. But there are also, for example, people consider co-expression networks where two genes are connected if their expression levels are highly correlated. And this is an example of non-physical biological network. What happens is that all these three examples, gene regulatory, protein-protein, and metabolic networks, they're usually considered separately and independently. Though obviously in the cell, they are interconnected and interrelated. So here, for example, on this scheme, the solid arrows are direct interactions, and dotted arrows are indirect interactions that occur via some intermediates. So for example, when we say that two genes are connected in a network, we actually mean that this gene I produces protein P, right? For example, that is a transcription factor that actually works on gene two. But again, when people look at biological networks, they just consider them independently on these three sort of parallel planes. Just a very quick recap, what are biological networks? Everybody knows that it's common to represent them as graphs where a node is either a gene, a protein, or metabolite. And an edge that connects the two nodes represents some kind of association, interaction, or co-expression, or whatever, between these two nodes. People consider either directed networks, where there is a direction from one node to the other, or indirected networks. For example, gene regulatory networks are directed networks, and protein-protein interactions are indirected networks. Whatever networks people study in biological networks, it seems that there are some common properties between them. For example, small world property, although I think on Monday when Sergey was giving his talk, some people doubted that, you know, the biological networks have small world property, but I agree that if it's shown otherwise, biological networks have this small world property, which means that they have this short mean path between two random nodes. Another common property of biological networks is that there are many nodes with few connections and a few nodes with many connections, so-called hubs. And again, that's everybody agrees about it, and perhaps that's the second property is just a consequence of the first, of the small world property. And then there was another property that recently has been questioned, that these hubs, these highly connected nodes, are enriched with essential or lethal genes, proteins, so-called lethality and centrality property. It was also suggested and shown, and again, recently has been questioned, that these hubs are highly evolutionarily conserved. But several people questioned this. For example, Andreas Wagner showed that actually deleting or knocking out these hubs doesn't disrupt the network, is not lethal for an organism compared to, say, networks with other, with a fewer number of connections. And also, for example, Sarah Teichman in one of her works showed that the hubs of gene regulatory networks in various bacteria actually not evolutionarily conserved. So every network has its own hubs, but they are different. They're not evolutionarily conserved. So this kind of this has been recently questioned. One of the common and probably simplest measures of the network, or the sort of description of the network, is its degree distribution. So the degree or a connectivity of a certain node is just simply a number of connections that it has, right? So this node A has 5 connections here. And this is in an undirected network. And if we're looking at directed network, I don't think you see little arrows here. But anyway, this node A would have its in-degree distribution would be 4, and there is only one out-degree here from node A. And then we can introduce the degree distribution, that is the probability that a selected node has exactly k links, right? And networks are classified by their degree distributions. So first of all, there are this random network. So you just take certain number of nodes and just with a certain probability connects these some of the nodes randomly. And then the degrees in the random networks, they follow a Poisson distribution. So most nodes have roughly the same number of links, which approximately equals to the network's average degree. And nodes that have significantly more or less links than this average number of k are actually very rare. That's the random network. Biological networks, as we know, have a few nodes with a large number of links and many nodes with only a few links, which obviously indicates that there is an absence of a typical node in a network. And the question is, are these networks scale-free, and what does scale-free actually means here? I think the concept of scale-free networks has been introduced relatively recently, I think in 1999, 1998, by Barabasi and his group, and it has been very widely popularized by him and his group and his followers. But anyway, this is an example of random and scale-free networks. And for example, here, this is the random networks, and 5 highly connected nodes with most links, they're shown in red, okay? And they're connected to only 27% of all other all nodes. So they're shown in green. And in the scale-free networks, the 5 most connected nodes, again here shown in red, they are connected to 60% of all nodes, okay? So this is just a comparison between the random and scale-free network. It has been shown that all various biological networks are scale-free, and there is a bunch of papers from metabolic protein-protein interactions, protein domain, gene interactions, gene regulatory networks, co-expression networks, and all of them have been shown to be scale-free. Okay? Again, most of these networks are sort of experimental networks, but with exception of this examples, gene co-expression networks, where there is just certain threshold and the nodes are connected if their correlation is higher than this threshold. But all of them have been claimed to be scale-free, and like everybody accepts that's to be the case. And it actually went further, so people started looking for other biological scale-free examples virtually everywhere. For example, distribution of gene expression levels and spot intensities on microarrays, also scale-free. Or frequency of occurrence of generalized parts in genomes of different organisms scale-free, et cetera, et cetera. You can go for various biological examples that are claimed to be scale-free. And of course, there are various other examples of scale-free networks. For example, network of citations between scientific papers is scale-free. Networks, various social networks, networks of collaborations, and then physical networks like electrical power grids, airline traffic routes, railway networks, and so on, as well as, of course, World Wide Web and Internet. And Barabasi and started kind of one of his papers, for example, said the following, that these laws apply equally well to the cell and the ecosystem, demonstrate how unavoidable nature's laws are and how deeply self-organization shapes the world around us. So kind of from all these sort of findings, people started making very deep conclusions. That's just another example. If you type scale-free networks in Google, I think fourth or fifth link is that terrorist networks are scale-free, and what does it matter for counter-terrorism experts? And obviously there are certain hubs and so on, and you know, if you want to disrupt the network, then you should go for a hub and not for the random network, and so on. It's globalguerrillaswhatever.com, and there are several articles and advising counter-terrorism experts on how to deal with scale-free terrorist networks. There's also a website, www.scalefree.info, which is on tools for a connected, distributed, and backed-up existence, kind of advice on social networking. So it goes on. So kind of everything is claimed to be scale-free. As I mentioned, so it was Barabasi and his group who kind of popularized this concept, and this is the front, I think, page from Scientific American in 2003, I think, again saying that scientists have recently discovered that various complex systems have an underlying architecture governed by shared organizing principles, and this insight has important implications for a host of applications from drug development to internet security. It has been claimed that this is some kind of a unifying paradigm, okay? And in the study of complex networks in biology, physics, and social sciences. And just yet another quote, you know, talking about philosophical input. I think Eugene Koonin was here a couple of weeks ago, and this is from one of his papers. Again, these findings have considerable philosophical input. The power law connectivity distribution seen in scale-free networks seems to emerge as one of the very few universal mathematical laws of life. So here we go. Right, it's actually very interesting why there has been such an interest in scale-freeness of biological networks and of other networks for that matter. First of all, it's just very nice one parametric distribution. So you just have to adjust one parameter and you actually get to describe the distribution of connections in various types of networks. And it is this parameter that is claimed to depend on the type of the network. And that's it, right? It's also kind of nice that the presence of hubs, some kind of important essential hubs in the networks, and a large number of nodes with very few connections. And this has been cited as the most characteristic feature of scale-free biological networks, okay? And scale-free networks have small load property and they're robust to random breakdowns. Yes?
The real reason why scale-free became so popular is because, well, at least the real reason why the network was originated is because Barabasi had a background in physical physics, and also for physicists used to have this, you know, soft spot for scale-free.
Absolutely.
Because they thought that, you know, whenever they see something solid, figured that means that they don't have to care about a lot of details.
Absolutely. But, I mean, it's
surprising that it kind of penetrated much.
Oh yeah, I think it's everywhere. I mean, it's just it's really penetrated beyond community of physicists. I think a majority of physicists don't believe it anymore.
Right, but penetrated. I think the term changes nature. They
of
don't
course,
care whether it's
absolutely.
Or any other problem.
That's true. You're absolutely right. But what I'm going to try to say that, well, scale free is obviously described by the power law, and that's the only mathematical formula that describes scale free networks. And in fact, this property that is most often cited as characteristic of scale free networks, it's not unique. Any broad tail or broad scale distribution has this property, okay? Scale-free networks are just one class of small world networks, and there are other broad scale distributions that are also small world and also have a few hubs. Sergei said, the term scale-free comes from statistical physics, okay? And the unique property of scale-free networks or scale-free systems is the invariance to changes in scale. So basically, if a scale-free system is defined by some functional form that remains unchanged within a multiplicative factor under a scaling of the independent variable. And effectively, this means the power law forms, because these are the only solution for this type of equation. That's kind of obvious. So network is defined as scale-free if a randomly picked node has k connections with a probability that follows the power law. Okay, that's the kind of the formal definition of it. Can also kind of rephrase this invariance under rescaling by writing, for example, this simple relation, that the ratio of two connectivities in a scale-free network is invariant. Okay, so here it is. And this implies that scale-free networks are self-similar, right? So we can study any part of the network and it will be statistically similar to the whole network, and parameters will be independent of the system size. And this is an example. I really like this example. It's from a paper by Gomez Rzhetsky. It's a cauliflower, okay? And the cauliflower, if you take the whole vegetable, or a part of it, or a part of a part of it, and just make a picture of it, you wouldn't be able to tell which one, unless you compare it here with the match. This gives you a characteristic size of it. And what I also liked in there, it was a paper, I think, in Bioinformatics Journal or something, and it was written, note vegetable, in materials and methods, vegetable was purchased in Sloan supermarket. So that's kind of an example of a scale-free system, okay? You look at a part of a system and you don't know whether it's the whole system or part of it and so on. Right. So what's been generally done to show that the biological network is scale-free, or its connectivity distribution is scale-free, is to fit a straight line to a log-log plot here. So this is a log of the connectivities, okay, and this is the log of the frequencies. And yes, you can fit a straight line, but you can also fit many other curves here. I mean, and kind of putting a straight line through all these points doesn't make the points follow this straight line and so on. And both these papers, well, this is a paper, I think, in Nature Science, where the group of Tong et al. Did some very good experimental studies on genetic interactions. And then it kind of became common now in all experimental papers to make this kind of plot and to claim that, oh, by the way, our network is also scale-free. And this is a paper, this is for yeast as well. This is a gene regulatory network, also published in Nature 2002. This is a network with transcription factors and gene targets and so on. And again, the fit is the straight line here. And usually the line is either fitted by the least square method or whatever, but this is kind of to show that the connectivity follows the scale-free distribution, the power law distribution. So this is... Well, I'm saying that you can fit any line you want here.
Not any,
but you can fit many lines here, and perhaps the straight line, you know, it doesn't fit here at all. And claiming based on this that this network of experimental interactions is scale-free is kind of a bit far-fetched. Sorry? Here? No. Well, I'll show how I mean I think you know one way how to check whether the network is scale free, but what I'm claiming is that you know people just put their experimental points here and then make a straight line, and then they make you know deep conclusions about it all, you know, universal laws, etc., etc. No. Yes, yeah. This is not a power law. No. No. Yeah, perhaps. Perhaps, yeah. Yeah, perhaps. Yeah. Okay. What I'm saying also that it's one actually needs to apply some other methods rather than just fitting a straight line using whatever least squared approach or whatever. Basically, so just what people do, they look at this is the formula for the power law distribution, right? And this is some normalization function, Roman zeta function. Then just by taking a log, okay, that's obviously that you should get a straight line, okay. But obviously the logarithms can track data. We have data that measured unequally, and the fits is not particularly good, as I hope I showed on the previous slide. So what we decided to do, we decided to apply very standard statistical technique, goodness of fit test, just to see whether these observed experimental networks of interactions follow the power law. And so we can write a likelihood function where xi is a connectivity of node I, okay? And then we can just maximize the log likelihood with respect to gamma. That's how we find the gamma. That's the only parameter in the power law. I have to say immediately here that, of course, by writing this formula, we assume that the connectivities are independent, which they are not. And I'll show later that we relax this assumption and we get essentially the same results. So we just write the likelihood and maximize it with respect to gamma. And then we just do a standard goodness, Kolmogorov goodness of fit test, where we compare, where we calculate the test statistic, we calculate their observed and expected values for the given gamma, Okay? And our new hypothesis is that the network is scale-free. So we pull various connectivity values over this K star, for which the expected values are less than 5, and calculate the p-value, which is the exceedance probability of a chi-squared distribution here. And the p-value will be the probability that a network has such connectivities if they were drawn from the power law distribution. Okay? That's all the analysis, basically. And then we take 10 very popular data sets, and we do the analysis for each of these 10 data sets. Well, we took more, but here I show 10. We calculate the gammas and the p-values. Now, the first, I think, six data sets here, they are the protein-protein interaction data sets. The first three are for yeast, protein-protein interactions. Rain, I think, is C. elegans, and Guillot is Drosophila, protein-protein interactions. This is the Tong data set of genetic interactions in yeast. This is, I think, cheap data. This is gene regulatory network. And this is this co-expression network constructed from the cell cycle data, yeast cell cycle data, from the experimental data by Spellman and Cho. And many people, again, constructed these co-expression networks, and they claimed that the networks are scale-free. Okay, so here we have 10 data sets. We also looked at various metabolic data sets. And yes? Yes. Because, you know, if it's scale-free, it's described by the power law. Well, depends. I mean, the definition, yes. The definition is, that's the definition, right? No, that's the definition of the scale-free network. Various people, I mean, there are, what would you say, yes? Yeah. No, it's just.
I never heard your distribution, but I totally love what people say. And of course, it is a power law in disguise, but it's scale free. And you change the scale, and you can see the safety, not to change it overall for the other people. That's power law.
Which is scale free?
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is every power law is scale free, but not everything.
Yeah, but I guess it's the same as, you know, with the small world. I think we had the same kind of arguments. Well, that's what people are using, and that's, I think, I looked at various literature from statistical physics as well, not just, you know, biological literature. That's, so the scale-free is invariant under the changes in scale, right? That's the kind of the definition. And the only mathematical form, Yeah, but that's what people. Yeah, scale invariant, scale free. That's already. Well, that's. I don't think so. I think when people claim that the network is scale-free, they usually present this type of graph. Yes, that's. I'm talking about, you know, majority of papers, biological papers. So, and that's how they say, by the way, our network is also scale-free, and that's what I don't think they mean scale invariant or given by some other more sophisticated, which I don't know what it is. Yes, yeah. So basically, yeah, that's what it is. So, and, okay, so we looked, we took all these 10 data sets, calculated gamma just by simply maximizing the log likelihoods, and then calculated the p-values, which are all very, very small for all these 10 data sets. So here, p-value summarizes the evidence against the null hypothesis that the network is scale-free, and obviously suggesting that the networks are not consistent with Pauli distributions, okay? So there is another candidate here, truncated power law. And truncated power law looks something like that. So it's on a log-log plot, you get a straight line up to from 1 to, say, Kc, right? Kc is another parameter over there. And then the number of connections is less than expected for the power law for k greater than kc. That tails off here. Okay? And that's been suggested as one of the other candidates for what is describing the connectivity distribution for experimental networks. Again, we did a similar analysis, but now we have two parameters. We have gamma and we have this k cutoff. And indeed, you see that for some of the networks, you get pretty reasonable p-values here, right? So some of these networks actually might be described by truncated power law. However, if you look here, for example, then the Kc, so that this cutoff, is rather small. So here it's only, you know, 8.7, 6.2. Huh? Yeah, so it's really, really small. So, and then 11. The only exception is this co-expression network, which is, as I pointed out before, is not actually a physical network, okay? So only here you can have a kind of power law up to 73 or 99, depending on the threshold that you take for the correlations when you build this this network. So otherwise, some of them have still have very small p-values here, and the others, even if they are given described by the power, by the truncated power law, only on a very short range of the connectivities. I mentioned that when we were doing this analysis, we assumed that all the connectivities are independent, which is obviously not the case. And then we relax this independence assumption, and we sampled from each of the networks, we sampled, I think, 1,000 times, we sampled small subnetworks, which contain about 1/10 of the nodes in the original network, and we performed the analysis again. And again, these are the gammas for the power law that we got, and these are the p-values, which are, again, very, very small here. So the again, we have evidence that these networks are not described by, or the connectivity distributions of these networks are not described by the power law. Okay, so you might say, so what? So who cares, right? Whether it's scale-free or truncated or whatever, you can come up with any other type of distribution. First of all, it's obviously important to understand the network architecture. It's also, I think the idea is that once we understand how these networks are constructed, then perhaps we'll be able to build some growth models or evolutionary models to understand how these networks actually were built or were, how they actually evolved over time. And another important criteria here is this scalability or self-similarity of the networks. So if the networks are not scale-free, then actually we have to exercise caution when applying the features of an already started of an already studied part of the network to investigate the properties of the whole network, okay, or other networks that seem similar. And example is that again this paper in Guelsim and co-authors in Nature 2002, where by making this plot, they concluded that the connectivity of gene transcriptional network for yeast in E. coli scale free. Then they went on by saying that bacterial and fungal genetic networks are free of characteristic scale with respect to the distributions of both regulating and departing connections. And we found that this scale-free property doesn't even hold, and therefore such kind of biological conclusions are invalid. So it's important, as I said, to get the topology right, because we would like to build some growth models, evolutionary models, to understand how these networks evolved. The original concept of creating scale-free networks, the original model of how they can appear, is the so-called preferential attachment model. It's the model where sort of the rich gets richer. So if a node has a large number of connections, then it has a higher probability than adding another one, and so on and so on. But that has nothing to do with biology in a sense. And then people started coming up with various models, evolutionary models, and then to adjust parameters of these models in order to get scale-free network. For example, these duplication and divergence models, where a newly created node inherits all or part of the connections of the parent node, the authors of all these papers, they had to adjust the parameters, the frequencies, and so on, the probabilities, in order to get the scale-free network, because that's something that you want to get at the end, or they wanted to get at the end. In this model, birth, death, and innovation model, in order to get a scale-free network, they had to adjust various rates. They had to get some kind of balance between all these birth, death, and innovation processes, because the ultimate goal was to get this scale-free network. And if the networks are not scale-free, then there is no point actually to playing with all these parameters in order to get this type of networks. In other models, for example, was shown that such a plausible evolutionary phenomena as evolutionary drift actually contradicts the power law. If you introduce it into the model, then you will not be able to get this the connectivity that is given by the power law. And Johannes Berg and Michael Lasik, they have a model for link dynamics and gene duplications, which results in broad connectivity distribution. So they showed that if the link attachment detachment rate is, and they estimated it actually from protein-protein interaction data, that if it's faster than the duplication rate, then you get a network with broad connectivity distribution without, you know, having this scale-free property which one doesn't need here. So the bottom line is that the qualitative properties of biological networks still hold. So obviously we still have hubs, we still have these few nodes with many connections and many nodes with a few connections. We have a small world property and various other measures, high clustering of nodes and so on and so forth. So all these qualitative features still hold true. And then one can come up with all sorts of other distributions, like, for example, truncated power law, generalized truncated power law, stretched exponential distribution, and so on and so forth. For example, Natasha, I cannot pronounce her name, I know her. Geometric, she showed that geometric random graph, for example, is a very good description of large number of biological networks. And also Michael Stumpf and his colleagues at Imperial College showed that they applied various formal statistical model selection methods to determine which functional form best describes networks. And they showed that this is not the power law. So in a way, it is important, and perhaps there isn't just one, but perhaps there are various various different forms that can be fitted, that can describe the connectivity distribution of different networks, but the power law isn't one of them. And if this wasn't enough, if you still think, oh, perhaps it's scale-free and so on, if you don't agree with the analysis steps, there have been other kind of work done recently that showed the following things. First of all, people talk about protein-protein interaction networks. And it's known that the protein-protein interactions networks have been only sampled partially, even for the yeast network. Out of, let's say, 6,000 proteins, only 4,900 have been actually sampled, have been measured. And there were two works recently by two different groups where they showed that sampling of networks with different topologies can result in scale-free network, or in something that is similar to a scale-free network. It depends how you sample. And of course, experimentalists don't sample networks randomly. They all have their favorite proteins or the proteins that are easier to measure. And the choice of these baits in the experiments is not completely random. So that's one thing. On the contrary, Michael Stumpf showed that the subnets of scale-free networks are not scale-free. That's another interesting thing. Again, it depends on your sampling strategy, okay? And because we only have partial information here, so it's very prematurely to talk about the actual distribution of the protein-protein interaction networks. And these protein-protein interaction networks contain lots of non-specific interactions, okay? And some of them have, you know, some of the non-random topological features need not have any evolutionary origin or any kind of deep meaning. So the conclusion is that the observed topology of these subnets cannot be confidently extrapolated to complete networks. So the question is whether there is a network topology or there isn't. We can still debate about it, but I think the bottom line is that we need to get the topology right. We shouldn't look at some oversimplifications that is given by the power law, and then when we sort out this first problem, we can move on to other things here. So I think that's it.